Call this meeting of the Energy Subdivision to order. And Senator Olsen, I think we'll hear about what you're doing with your trade association first. And why don't you explain what you're doing, and then we'll listen to your witnesses.
Thank you, Senator Kubley and members. I appreciate being here today. One of the things I'm looking at, and I don't have this in a bill form yet, is looking at possibly working with the state on the state helping form a geothermal heat pump association. Wisconsin started their heat pump association with help of the state, kind of, I believe it was with SIP-type dollars to get the organization going. I have a number of testifiers today that are going to speak about geothermal and some of the advantages and ways that we can move forward in the state with this. Having served my first session on the Energy Committee and being such a dramatic renewable energy standard being passed, there's also the thoughts of by using less energy, we can save energy tremendously in this geothermal. I first really became aware of it when I toured a number of years ago one of the high schools in my district. I was in the boiler room, and they had no boiler. So here they have 25,000 gallons circulated underground outside the school, and they circulate through the building, and then through a series of air exchangers, they're raising the temperature from 50, 55 degrees, maybe 10 degrees. So it makes so much sense to look at a system like this, and that's kind of why we're here today. So one of the things that that I'm also looking at is looking at some certification of installers, because you hear horror stories of somebody making a bad installation, and that just puts a bad name on a kind of a growing industry here. Geothermal is not, when somebody's thinking about a home, they're not thinking about a geothermal heat pump system for their heating and cooling, and I would like to move towards changing that. I think that we can use the Earth's natural heat to help heat our homes in the winter and cool our homes in the summer. But if the word gets out that there's a bad installation, I mean, that just hurts everybody in the industry. So one thing I want to work towards is some sort of certification and licensure for those that install systems, whether that be overseen by the Department of Labor and Industry. I think that might be the correct avenue for that. So developing some standards of competency, and then one of the other big things is with the SIP dollars, this might be a real adequate or a responsible use for our SIP dollars to save energy by helping people install these systems. Initially, some of them are more expensive, but then the payback time, I think you'll see in your brochure, one of the installers had put in a record of what his energy costs are, and it's unbelievable in our climate that his annual costs are, I think, were like in the $600 range for heating and cooling a 4,000-square-foot home. So then I would kind of wrap up with looking at kind of going along the lines of Senator Kubley's bill, I believe, looking at a revolving loan, whether it's state dollars or the SIP dollars, that maybe some no-interest loans, that the money goes out, and as it comes back in, it can go back out again for more installations. So that's kind of where I'd like to go with this, and the first person I have to testify will be Brian Yearland from the geothermal heat pump factory rep for GeoComfort. So,
okay.
Do you want to sign in?
Sure. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Brian Erlob, and appreciate you having me here this morning. Appreciate everything Senator Olsen is doing for our industry. I guess one thing that I would like to testify with our industry is that we are growing at a very rapid rate, but if you look at the overall heating industry in this country, we're less than 1% of the total market. Back to what Senator Olsen had said is that we have to change the paradigm of what people think about when they're going to heat and cool their homes. I think an association in the state would help do that with some marketing and advertising as a non-biased association for our industry to help get the word out that this is an excellent way to heat and cool your home, not only to save money, but to save energy. We can save a tremendous amount of energy, which then goes into saving the environment. The carbon emissions, the carbon footprint of a geothermal heat pump system is the best technology that's available today. And that's really what we all need to be looking at. And that's the word that we need to spread, is we're not only going to help save some people some money, but we can help save the environment and save some energy. An association would be a huge step for us. We could also incorporate, Senator Olsen was saying, some standards, some quality standards of installation, some guidelines. We also would have a tracking system that we could use to figure out how many of these systems are going in, how well are they working, why did they purchase geothermal. We could use that in a lot of different ways to really help our industry grow. Part of the problem with the industry growing is we don't have enough people already. I mean, we're all very busy right now. And as the industry grows, we're going to struggle with, you know, getting these systems installed, especially on the vertical loop installations. We've got a gentleman here that's going to talk about that. Right now, we're already having trouble finding more people to come into this industry. And it comes down to supply and demand. I think as we increase the demand, some of these people will recognize this industry as a viable business, and they want to be able to get into that and be a part of it. So we need to increase the sales to get more people involved to make this a commodity level. Right now, we are not a commodity. Most people look at this as strictly for the high-end homes. You know, I hate to say it, but more for the wealthy or for the rich. So it's not a commodity by any means. In order to get it more of a commodity level, we need more people involved. Also on the technology side, as more people get involved, I think we'll have more technology on how we can do this better, faster, for less money, more efficiency. So as this industry grows, we'll see all those things happening. But right now we're having trouble just getting to the next level, which is, you know, more than 1% of the total heating industry. And so that's really all. I mean, I think he's doing excellent work. I know the association would be a tremendous help for our industry. The problem is we've got all these great ideas, and we can sit around as manufacturers and distributors and installers, but we can't get legs under those ideas. So if we had an association and we had some support maybe for the first 5 years from the state, we could get some legs under those ideas by having a full-time person kind of taking those ideas and being able to run with them. Because right now, for instance, the Wisconsin Association, they had that for a few years. It was going great. The funding got pulled, that person got let go, and now it's kind of sitting there stagnant and has no meaning for the members, and it isn't doing anything for the industry. So number one, I think we have to have some teeth to the association, some good that makes people want to become members, and we need somebody there to put the legs under the ideas.
Well, Mr. Erlove and maybe Senator Olsen, you know, if we're going to standardize, you know, the criteria by which these systems are installed, I mean, you know, what's your vision in terms of training for people that would actually carry out the work then? I mean, if we're going to have it standardized, it seems to me we have to have some kind of vehicle to get the information out there. And, you know, how is that going to happen, and who would be conducting those training sessions?
Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, I believe the Department of Labor and Industry would probably be the avenue for licensure or certification of installers. But we have a testifier later on, Mr. Strandland, who is an installer, and he may be able to address some of those concerns better than I. But one other point that I was talking with these guys earlier is that on talking to some, like, Minsku presidents of campuses and just kind of asking them whether or not they've ever looked at alternative energy systems or other people that run state facilities. And they say, you know, they may look at it in the plans, but as the capital bonding bill is established and things, their dollars get cut back, you know, usually that's the first thing they would cut out is an experimental heating system. So one thing also that may help this energy savings effort would be looking at in the capital bonding bill, maybe having a separate category for these kinds of heat systems, because it seems like, you know, there's always a crunch for dollars, and, you know, that would usually be the first thing to go. You know, then they take the brick out and put in sheetrock, you know, so they're always paring back to meet the funds they actually get. So whether we could also look at some way of helping our state institutions being able to install these systems, because I think the payback is twofold. Number one, their operating costs are reduced because of the energy savings, and number two, we're not putting as much carbon in the air. We're not burning as much oil or gas or electricity. So I don't know if that answered your question, but
maybe if I could add to that a little bit. We had a meeting yesterday. We talked about this. We have a national association that kind of has a program in place right now that we could piggyback off of for an accredited installer program, where every year you have to go and get continuing education credits to stay up with the industry, to continue your education so you're doing things properly. And if the association or through another avenue, we could piggyback on what they've already established and make it for our particular state, because they're in Oklahoma City. So we do things a little bit different up here. But if we could use some of their guidelines and we could use that through the association, I think that would be one way we could, that may be the vehicle that we could use to get this standard set.
Okay. You know, Mr. Lubb, you're not aware of what, have other states done a standardization for installers, and, you know, do they have a certification program, or is this?
I'm not aware of any states right now that have any type of standard set. Other than maybe a code of ethics, you know, the Iowa Heat Pump Association kind of has a standard as far as business practices, but they don't have a standard as far as installation is concerned. So we would be, I think, the first one taking that step, you know, in doing that.
Okay. You know, would you suggest then, Mr. Urlaub, that we leave that kind of thing to the association, that the association would then establish the process by which you become certified, or as opposed to the state, for instance, Mr. Urlaub?
I think maybe that would be a good way to go. I think the association, the problem with associations a lot of times is there isn't any benefit for members to sign up and pay their dues, which could help keep a person on staff. If we had something like this as an association where we are now in charge of training these people and they have to, you know, then become a member to be on the website and so forth, I think that would give the association, number one, some credibility, but then it would also turn around and give the industry some credibility in the state. So I think as an association, that would be the place to have that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, you know, the hardest thing in this place to accomplish when you start monkeying with licensures and standards, I've been through that from building trade from one end to the other.
Yeah.
It just kind of puts a flag. I think it's all right, but I want to warn you, Senator, that sometimes that's not the easiest thing to get accomplished in this place. But I think we need to have some kind of a handle on it, because I was reading this, and it intrigues me if it would work, and for the simple reason that, you know, if you put underground water system at home, and I happen to have rural water, there's just a little metal box that goes down, and that's the heat from that ground. It keeps that from freezing, and it never freezes. I don't care if it's 40 below, it never freezes. So the heat does come from the ground. I think that's a good part.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you have to look that we're creating another, maybe a department that we have to fund. So it's more than just, if you don't have somebody carrying the big stick and seeing everybody's doing what they're supposed to do, we have to find some way to do that. So I think your idea is all right. I just wanted to warn you, Senator, those are obstacles that you'll have to overcome.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the purpose of our hearing today is primarily to gather information, to look at what the possibilities might be, and, you know, Senator Olsen had this idea that kind of fit in with what we were looking at. So, well, anything else, Mr. Erlob?
Well, just to maybe expand on his point a little bit, and that's one of the reasons why associations have never really created standards for installation or guidelines, because they're afraid of the liability. If they're now certifying an installer and he does something wrong, can the consumer come back to the association? And that's the fine line that we have to walk and figure out a way. Can we do this and make it a viable part of the association without creating a liability issue? And I think we can. And I think that would raise the level of the installations in the state. And it would maybe, you're never going to weed out all the bad ones, but you're going to, I think, weed out a lot of the consumer buyer beware, if you will, problems that have been out there in this industry. And as it grows, you're going to see more of that because people are looking at this as an industry that, hey, I can get in and I can start out of my garage and I can start putting these in and make money because there's nobody watching over me. And so we kind of have to, you know, try to stay away from that as much as possible. Part of that comes on my responsibility as manufacturer and who I'm doing business with. But it also, I think, would help if an association had something that, you know, that could maybe, you know, have a standard there to help that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Vickerman, number one, Senator, I appreciate your experience around here, so any guidance and those things, I respect what you say, so I'll listen closely. Number two, it does work. It's amazing. You know, that's why I think we're here, is because we need to get the word out that, you know, we could be having so much more energy efficient homes by having a system like this. And it's not just the savings in the heating cycle, but there's tremendous savings in the cooling cycle in the summer. And that's using the coolness of the earth then. And so it's just an amazing system that I think that if more people knew about it, and we maybe had a way of funding it or helping people get into it without any extra cost than a conventional system, I think we'd see some dramatic savings in energy in our state.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Well, just to follow up on that, Senator Olsen, I think, I agree with you that I think we should, you know, whenever we build a new state building with public dollars or local building for that matter with state dollars in our bonding bill, we should make sure that they use every energy-saving device available to save energy that's reasonably cost-effective. And so we should have geothermal systems going into a lot of these new construction projects. But the question is, what is the barrier to making, is it, I mean, how you said something about, sir, about only the wealthy are putting these into their homes, or at least that's the perception. So what would it take to make geothermal systems affordable for the average person who's building a new home or has an existing home? I mean, what amount of money is it? What percent of your heating system additional would it cost to incorporate this? I mean, is the biggest problem just that it's too expensive?
Okay. Senator Olsen.
And what's the payback period?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, one of the concerns, it's probably ballpark $7,000 to $8,000 more expensive than a conventional system. So that, you know, if somebody's getting into their first home or whatever, they're looking to it, getting in as cheaply as possible. So it's going to be hard for them to look at putting in a system that costs a lot more money. So that's probably the biggest barrier, is the initial cost.
But what's the payback period on that?
Well, if you look at Mr. Strandland's numbers there for his heating costs, I mean, that's pretty phenomenal right there, that his total heating and cooling costs for his 4,500 square foot home. I mean, what has he got in February? He's averaging, you know, probably a little under $100 a month for heating costs. That's pretty phenomenal. So that, I think, is your payback, that you will save back those dollars in energy savings. I can't say how many years it would take, but I bet if I had a calculator here, I probably could figure it out.
Do you know the answer to that, Mr. Stein?
Yeah,
Mr. Erlob.
Typically, we run a lot of cost analysis for our consumers when they're asking us to look at a geothermal system. And what we're seeing on a new home is anywhere from 5 to 10 years typically for a payback. However, what we're showing them, a cost of home ownership the day they move in on a new home, they're actually money ahead the day they move in by adding that into their mortgage. And the new homes really haven't been the issue. We've seen a lot of new homes going with geothermal. We're growing in that market. However, the new home market's going down. But the retrofit market is really an untapped market, and that's where now you're talking $10,000 to $20,000 more than a conventional system to replace. So that now your payback gets stretched out 10 to 15 years, where if we could have something to offset that upfront cost, if we can keep that less than 7 years, they're gonna recognize and see that that's a good payback.
So, Mr. Chair, I know in solar there's some tax credits that are available, and we've had sales tax exemptions for solar, or at least we've contemplated that, installations in Minnesota. I mean, none of it, I don't think it adds up to be enough for most consumers to make that decision, but are any of those incentives available that you're aware of for geothermal? Or do these qualify for any SIP programs that you're aware of?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, we're going to have some testimony from Mr. Doherty from Dakota Electric, and I think he can answer that better. So if we can just hold on to that for a few minutes, I'd appreciate that.
And then, Mr. Chair, just Senator one other Anderson. Question. I'm just wondering about the Commerce Department because, you know, they have a lot of staff who they have a whole assistant commissioner now whose job is renewable energy, and I don't know if that fits under renewable energy or conservation. It's sort of a hybrid. But is Commerce doing anything to help here that you're aware of?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, yes, they are. I had a meeting with some of their representatives, and I think they will be willing to work with us. And if that's the avenue that we go, that's fine, too. And I'll continue with some more meetings with them and see about – they did have some hesitation, I must say, in developing a – funds from the public dollars in a trade association, because then, you know, what about the solar people then? And so that's kind of, they felt might be a slippery slope. But as far as working towards expanding the industry, I think they were very interested in doing that. But maybe not so far as, you know, having state dollars go to an association. Well, that's a hurdle.
Well, Mr. Chair, another Senator approach, Anderson. I think a lot of legislators might have the same concern, but another approach would be to try to pay for a staff person in the Department of Commerce, or at least a part of a staff person whose job it would be to help promote the industry and to promote, I mean, they couldn't do it in terms of helping, individual companies be more profitable per se. That wouldn't be their mission per se. It would be to try to promote the use of geothermal systems and to help set standards and those sorts of things. I mean, I think that's what the Department of Commerce should already be doing. And if they're not, we should see how we can make them do that. That might be another approach.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay. Mr. Erlaub, anything else, sir?
No. Okay. I don't have anything else. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming, Senator Olsen. Do you want to ask your next witness?
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to jump down to Mr. Strandlin because he's an installer just north of my district. He installs systems in my district, and he can kind of give us the 101 on these systems and kind of where he thinks the potential is also.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Strandlin. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Jim Strandlin. Thank you, Senators, for allowing us to speak here today. And a couple of issues that were brought up from Mr. Erlaub in the initial consultation has to do with licensing. State of Minnesota requires us as a contractor to be bonded and licensed presently. The problem has is there's no teeth in it. Nobody, it's like a voluntary thing. None of the municipalities, none of the cities that I deal with require us to show proof of insurance. Proof of this licensing procedure, et cetera. I personally know of at least four contractors in our district or my area that are operating, installing geo, installing gas systems without the safety regards of this licensing and proof of bonding. So that is in there, but there's no teeth. Nobody from the state of Minnesota is checking us as contractors to see if we are. And so there's a lot of gaps going on right there. I have been installing geothermal systems for over 12 years now, and I've been a heating contractor, refrigeration contractor since the early 80s. I see a lot of bad installations out there, and I see a lot of good ones as well. The problem is that our company typically maybe helps out 10 or 12 systems installed by other people a year that have done very substandard with a lot of major issues and problems. And that's where some of the goals and the guidelines as of an association could stick with, as well as some help from maybe the Department of Commerce or some of the people that have these rules and regulations that we're supposed to follow already, would be a great thing. People say, well, let's use the Better Business Bureau. Well, a couple of contractors, nobody ever seems to use that or file claims against. And so as a consumer can go and look at the Better Business Bureau and say there's nothing wrong with him, he should be a good contractor. A lot of homeowners are looking to build, go first to their power company, electrical cooperatives, and ask them about geothermal, as I find that they are one of the greatest allies that I have in this industry. Most of our power companies offer rebates incentives to consumers for new home construction or retrofit market as well. And this is where I would like to see something in the state, maybe if there was some kind of revolving loan program or something you guys are offering as an incentive of the state, show the consumer that, you know, wow, this is a great technology. This is a earth-friendly environmental thing that we can do to help save the environment and save some energy. So that's part of what I see. The sheet that was given to you is my own personal home. I've kept track of my annual heating and cooling costs since my house was built, and these are just the last typical 6 years. This is all documented through, we have separate electric meters through the electrical cooperative, and we are paid a reduced rate just for our heating and cooling system. So these are actual correct numbers. I have several other installs that I have done that have very similar amounts, very similar designs, and have kept track of their heating and annual cooling bills. And it's nothing for us to typically save, you know, tremendously over a fossil fuel system. The one thing that the electrical cooperatives, we have seen that our rates are way more stable than, say, the fossil fuel environment, as we can well justify by filling up your gas tank at the gas station right now. Electric seems to be very more stable, and I'll let some of the other electrical companies expand on that. The fact of only the wealthy affording these systems, that is not true. But in the area, the district I am is not a very rich area, but we have a typical installation for a new home gas furnace system, maybe $12,000 to $15,000. The geothermal, maybe $18,000 to $22,000. So the extra difference of money, as it comes down to Mr. and Mrs. homeowner, would rather have nicer cabinets, rather have nicer carpeting, all this kind of stuff, because it's more economical on initial investment. That's why I think the awareness of a revolving loan program or some of these other things you're talking about will greatly enhance first-time home buyers or younger home people, as well as people to retrofit, give them a little bit of incentive to spend a little extra money so they can help the energy crisis, save the environment, as well as put more money back in their pocket eventually. But I do have a lot of pictures of some bad contractor installations. It's a very big goal and key of mine, if an association is started, that it does have some clout, does have some teeth. There are some national associations, which I belong to as well, that have some great background for this, but I think that an association would really help as a consumer awareness of some place to go and look to see who's accredited, who's gone through the school, who's gone through this training, who has not had negative feedback, per se.
Well, Mr. Strandland, I guess, you know, I thank you for providing this little chart here. I mean, these figures look pretty good, but now how does that compare to heating and cooling a similar-sized home? I mean, you know, I don't...
It's a lot less than my house.
Well,
and
yeah,
house
and my house isn't that big either, yeah.
Senator, as Mr. Erlob alluded to, we do have computerized programs that will take a new home or an existing home, enter all these factors in, and use today's marketable price of propane or natural gas, and will give them a very accurate cost analysis of what it will cost to heat this facility with conventional form versus geothermal. And it's nothing for us to see paybacks right now, what we're doing, in 4 to 5 years on a home. So if I'm going to spend $1,000 on geothermal, I just did one yesterday for a guy, his fossil fuel bills were over $4,500 compared to $1,000 for geothermal per year.
Okay. And the upfront costs, Mr. Strandland, are, I mean, you know, Senator Olson says $7,000 to $8,000 more for a home. Well, is that, you know, I mean, is there something that you could give us on that cost that would represent, you know, like a square foot basis, or doesn't the square footage really make much difference? Or I guess I'm kind of curious on
that. Senators, when you design and design a system for a house, every house is different. There's so many different avenues and ways a house is built, the way they're heated today with radiant floor technologies, with forced air technologies, so it's kind of hard to give you an exact, this is going to cost you exactly 8% more than something else. Depends on the type of windows you install. There are better, more energy efficient windows, which in our heat loss calculations have saved a homeowner 10% on his design size. Or if a person uses ICF cement construction or spray foam wall installations, the incentives there are saving 8 to 9% more again. So it's really tough. It's kind of on a case-by-case business. But in overall, typically, we're seeing, you know, Brian, Mr. Erlob said 5 to 10 years, but right now, with our compared to propane, we're looking at 5 years payback.
Okay.
So you're typically on a simple gas system versus a geothermal system, you know, we're looking at $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 in difference.
Okay. Senator Dale.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Strandland. Are these numbers that you've got on your chart, do they represent the cost of electricity to run the pumps only, or is there some other cost involved in this?
Mr. Strandland.
Senators, that is 100% of my heating and cooling costs only, which is all 100% electricity. So it runs the heat pump, the circulating pumps, the fan system for forced air blowing. What it doesn't reflect, obviously, is going to be, even if you had a gas system, is the electrical usage for clothes drying, refrigerators, freezers, et cetera. This is 100% just the heating and the cooling of my home.
And I think Senator Dale.
I think you said earlier that you had a separate meter, so you know exactly what this is?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And then in addition to this electrical cost, is there some ongoing other cost of repairs, maintenance, some of the things that break down, or some what's the life expectancy of the system?
Mr. Strandland.
Senators, our life expectancy of these systems are 25 to 30 years, a typical, as well as a gas furnace system. Maintenance costs are a lot less. We have a little fewer moving parts. We don't have the potential for carbon monoxide poisoning or explosions like some gas can do. In retrospect, I service a lot of heat pumps over the last 12 years. I don't see them having any more maintenance than a typical gas furnace, and actually somewhat less. My own personal home, I've had to service it once in 13 years, where we had a poor manufacturing process of a steel thing up in the heat pump that sprung a leak and was fixed. But overall, the longevity is very, very, very high with a geothermal heat pump.
Senator Dale?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Strandland. If it's reasonable to depreciate the geothermal heating and cooling system over 25 years, what would you consider reasonable to depreciate another system over the, say, propane or some other competing system?
Mr. Strandland.
Senators, that would be very similar. You know, an average life expectancy of a furnace heat exchanger is between 20 and 25 years.
Okay. Senator Dale, do you?
Well, I think it's a very interesting concept. I know there's a lot of people that are using it right now, and I certainly think it's a very good thing to do. I'm just wondering about the proposed revolving loan fund, if that's important, because based on what I know of these systems, and I have some in my area, why wouldn't local bankers and others that are providing financing for new housing and housing in general, why wouldn't they go ahead and provide the funding without the state getting involved with another revolving loan fund?
Mr. Strandland.
I'm not a financial expert, but we find today a lot of homeowners are strapped, and they're mortgaging themselves to the max with two people working, with child care, et cetera, and that sometimes an additional $6,000, $7,000 is out of their reach. And that's where we're a lot of banks have been good with it and stuff, but it's just they're still at 5%, 8%, whatever the interest rate is. And I think that to make consumer awareness a revolving credit low-interest program would be very beneficial.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Strandland.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I would go back to order and Jack Kendrick. He will offer some interesting testimony, I think, on how to do a retrofit in an urban area.
Okay, welcome to the committee, Mr. Hendrick.
Thank you. My name is Jack Hendrick. I'm a water well contractor from Maple Plain that 15 years ago we got into the geothermal drilling. Mainly our expertise at drilling has been on school projects because that's where it all started, was schools would do their bonding and get the money that they put in the geothermal, and they were very happy with it. While we were drilling these school wells, homeowners would come up once or twice per project and say, you know, we've been wanting to get geothermal, but none of our local drillers will do that. So we'd actually pull one of our rigs off, go drill the loop field, and then someone would come and install the loop field system. Over time, we evolved. My wife has a startup company now called UMR Geothermal, and they do residential installs. So we've seen a whole change in what the geothermal is doing. We actually have probably five installations within 2 miles of here that we've gone in and retrofitted people's houses in a downtown setting. We have the first highly efficient in Minneapolis, where it was a 3-ton system. It was a lead house is what I was looking for. First lead house in Minneapolis in affordable housing that we actually put the loop field in the driveway because it was in between two houses and the driveway went down for parking off-site. And we were able to put the loop fields in there. So we've been able to be very creative in where we can put the loop fields. We actually have a system up in the northwest angle, and that happens to be a plate exchanger, where they sunk a stainless steel plate out in the middle of Lake of the Woods and are using that for their air conditioning in the summertime. That gentleman is very impressed with the geothermal systems. Our building in Maple Plain was built in 1976 when Xcel was having some of their financing and helping with energy efficiency. We were able to retrofit our 1976 building. We put in radiant floor as well as two geothermal heat pumps, and we put the loop field right in our driveway. And we've had extremely, extremely good luck with that. I think it's had two breakdowns in the 6 years that it's been in. We rebuilt our own personal residence. We happen to live on Lake Minnetonka. And with the setback distances from lakes, because of the state of Minnesota rules and regulations and wells, we had to, again, get very creative on where these wells went. But we were able to find places that we could get the proper setbacks. And we've had one minor issue, which was a control panel in the control board in the heat pump itself, that's been our only issue. What I'd also like to address is some of my experience in what I've actually done in other organizations. I'm currently the Secretary of the National Groundwater Association. I'm a past president of the Minnesota Water Well Association, and I am on the advisory council for IGSPA, which is the International Ground Source Heat Pump Association. I am a very strong believer in trade associations. It's an opportunity for people to learn and continue an education, because as a water well contractor, every year I need to get 7 years of continuing education to stay on top of the what the industry is doing and the changes that are there. I'm also an accredited installer through IGSPA. I again have to get 7 credits to maintain my accredited installers. This training is invaluable. I mean, Jim went through some of the horror stories when we were standing outside of people that don't know how to install systems properly. That is going to be the thing above all that hurts this industry. the vertical portion that I do is regulated by the Minnesota Department of Health, that if I don't grout the wells properly, they will could possibly do an inspection and make us go back and regrout the wells to make sure that they're done properly. Horizontals, on the other hand, are not regulated at all. Someone could come in and put in improper materials and end up the system not working right. The systems do work. It's proven if they're installed by a qualified contractor, they're the best thing that's happened to the state. A lot of folks say Minnesota is not. In fact, I was one of them before we even got into geothermal. I said Minnesota is too cold. Minnesota is perfect because we have a balanced heating and cooling season. Unlike if you're down in Oklahoma, which is air conditioning dominated, their loop field temperatures do grow and they get less efficient. Whereas if you put in a closed loop system of vertical like we normally install, those systems will generally have a temperature variation will come back. It'll get, of course, very cold in the wintertime and warmer in about 75 degrees in the summer, but then we'll be back to our 50-degree typical ground temperature in the spring and in the fall. So it's just a wonderful system. I can't tell you how much we've enjoyed doing them, and we'd like to see it continue to expand. 1% is not big enough. We need to get more.
Mr. Hendricks, when you mentioned that a couple of your systems are installed in a driveway, that doesn't cause you any problems in terms of, you know, maintenance issues or?
Our vertical systems are high-density polyethylene.
And address the difference.
Okay. There's a whole bunch of different types of systems. We do verticals where typically we'll drill about 150 feet down with a 4-inch hole, set in 300 feet of high-density polyethylene pipe that has a 180-degree U-bend on the bottom so we can circulate fluid down and come back out again. High-density polyethylene is basically the same as gas pipe. So when you see the gas company putting gas lines in, that's a yellow high-density polyethylene. We put in a black, typically, high-density polyethylene. So on a, let's say at work, we put in 11 tons total, a 6-ton system and a 5-ton system. We'll spread the holes out on approximately 20-foot centers on a commercial system, so that will dissipate the temperature. Then we will use what's called a reverse return header, where the inlet on one side is number one in the series, and on the other side would be number six, so that you can balance flow going down through all these loops. So it's very important that the person that does the tie-in knows to make sure that every loop contributes. So you can have a loop field running either hot or cold.
Okay.
So then on what we call horizontal systems, is someone can take a large excavator or backhoe and dig either a trench or just some instances, they'll excavate the whole area wide open, and then they'll lay pipe either in what they call a slinky, which would be just coils running out, or they'll run a straight pipe system out and around and back. The horizontals require more area than the verticals do. And so that's where the verticals are more relative to a metropolitan setting than the horizontals are. Whereas, Jim, I'm sure most of your systems are horizontal systems out.
Okay.
And then there's also, we actually have what we call pond loops are getting to be somewhat more seen where if you've got a pond like a golf course could sink these same cages or the slim jims could put them out. If you have at least 10 feet of water, you can do the heating and cooling off of a pond loop also. So we have hybrids that can be run if you, let's say, on school systems where they don't want to, we can match them with a boiler cooling system so the loop field doesn't have to be quite as large. We're doing a whole bunch of things trying to make the systems as cost-effective as possible, and it still gets down to first cost because you get a drill rig out there drilling holes that we can typically make about 2 holes a day. You know, we've got to pay for the fuel and as well as the labor for the people that are doing that work, and we've tried to get the cost down. We try to get more efficient. But it's that first cost has always been an issue.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Members, Ms. Senator Anderson.
You mentioned that you installed several systems real close to here.
Yes.
Tell us about those. Are they residential or some other type place? And how much space do they take up? Are they all vertical?
When I got the call from this gentleman, his name slips me right now. I went down and I looked at the site, and his front yard could not have been any bigger than your table right there. It had rose bushes. It was just the most beautiful setting that you can imagine. And we had to go in with our drill rig. And I told him, you know, when this is done, it's going to look like a parking lot. He said, not an issue. I'll move all the stuff, and I'll take care of it. So all we really need, we actually have a rig now that's on the back of a Ford F-450 versus some of our bigger equipment are on tandem. What we normally try to tell people is our preference is if you can get a cement truck in there, I can get my drill rig in there because most people understand what a cement truck does. And so as long as we have our 8 feet on either side, we can back in straight lines, you know, and do them one right in a row. We've evolved also because a lot of people have this beautiful green grass that they want it green when they're done. We now have what we call clean sites, where we will actually contain all our drill cuttings while we're doing the work, bring in a sewer vac truck when we're done, and they will clean the site up that you can actually walk around the sites while we're drilling if the people want it to be a clean site.
Okay.
I wanted to mention, we were talking about, you know, the continuing education credits. The state of Wisconsin, to maintain my water well contractor's license, I have to get 7 hours every year of continuing ed, and that continuing education is only offered through the Wisconsin Trade Association. So that is one way to keep people together, to get them get continuing ed, and to possibly continue to assist in funding the Heat Pump Association if we can get that going. You know, Brian mentioned about how the Wisconsin Association, you know, went up and is now going falling off the face of the earth again. We had the Northland Heat Pump Association back 15 years ago, and that was very strong and moving forward. And all of a sudden, because it did not have a dedicated person running it, a full-time person, which is necessary to have an executive director to keep people active, to keep making sure that the association is doing what the members need and getting our message out to the people. I think for some way to get a trade association is almost mandatory if we want this technology to continue.
Okay. Thank you. Members, any other questions? Or? Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Hendrich. Senator Olsen.
Senator Kubley, next I'd like to bring up Mr. Doherty, and he's with Dakota Electric, and I'm hoping that he will have some answers on what incentives we might have from the power companies.
Morning.
Welcome, Mr. Doherty.
Thank you. My name is Timothy Doherty, and I work for Dakota Electric Association as a business account executive. First of all, I'd like to say I appreciate the efforts of Senator Olsen and the other gentlemen in the industry. I've been working for gas and electric utilities for about 15 years now, and part of my job is to deliver energy efficiency to our customers. I work mainly in the commercial side, so I'll speak more about that. That's where I have the most knowledge and have developed the most geothermal projects in commercial buildings. We're constantly asked by our customers, to find ways to save energy, to save costs. We do many, many things under the SIP program, a whole umbrella of energy efficiency measures that are allowed. Of all the work that I've done over the years, the geothermal has delivered the greatest cost savings and the greatest economy for commercial customers. Part of the reason for that is the energy intensity of commercial buildings. They use a great deal of heating energy. They use a great deal of air conditioning energy. They use a great deal of process energy. The geothermal technology has allowed these types of facilities to take advantage of the amount of air conditioning they do, the amount of heating they do, and to reuse essentially waste heat in these types of facilities. A couple examples of that are an ice arena. There's all kinds of facilities in which this works. And some of the objections that we get or some of the concerns that we hear is that, you know, will this work in an office building? Will it, you know, yes, it does. Does it work in an ice arena? Yes, it works in an ice arena. It works in a convenience mart. We haven't seen a facility yet where this technology is not applicable. Other thing that's impressive about this technology is that the industry has evolved, responded to challenges, responded to problems, fixed those, and really advanced the technology where I've been comfortable for a long time in promoting this technology and assisting my customers in implementing it. One of the questions that came up was economics of these systems. I have a sample of, if you'd like to see that, I have a sample of a commercial analysis of the payback. And I don't know if you want to. Okay. The simple paybacks is one way to look at the economics of a geothermal system. The simple payback I've seen range from anywhere from 2 years to 10 years. The question, is that economical? It depends on the type of organization and their requirements. It's really a value question. 2 years is fine for some organizations. 10 years is fine for other organizations. Mainly the first cost is the big challenge to overcome. This question was of financing also. I heard the question of financing. Why doesn't the customers or the individual's bank provide the financing? One organization I work for, we had a revolving loan fund for business installations. And curiously, these organizations, these businesses that I worked with, were viable organizations. They had good relationships with their bank, but they didn't want to do the geothermal unless they had another source of financing. Now, I don't know what the reasoning is behind that, but that made the difference. So I would say that it's a good idea. I mentioned that to Senator Olsen earlier. So I support that also. I don't have the answer as to why, but it does work, and it would help to promote the technology.
Well, Mr. Doherty, there's I understand that there's a greater savings in, you know, say air conditioning, overheating, or whatever, you know, your application is. But is it possible to separate those two out so that you can gain the greatest efficiency from each system, or are they generally installed together so that you have both heating and air conditioning off at the same unit?
A geothermal system does both. It does both functions. I think one of the greatest advantages or a great advantage of this, and I'll try to speak of this in terms of individual type of systems. Give you a hockey arena, for example. A hockey arena, in your standard arena, the way they make ice is by removing heat, and the heat is taken through the mechanical system and rejected to the atmosphere, gone forever. And then at the same time, they have heating needs, in which they usually burn fossil fuel. They need to heat flood water, they need to heat shower water, they need to heat the building, they need to heat the space. And so they're simultaneously throwing energy away and buying energy. The geothermal system integrates this. The heat that would normally be thrown away from the heating, from the refrigeration system, is captured, recirculated back into the building, and used for those heating purposes. Sometimes additional ground loop is needed when it's very cold, several weeks a year, and heat is drawn from the earth during those times. So essentially, this system captures waste heat.
Okay.
And that's true in many types of buildings. We have been able to give conservation improvement dollars for these systems, mainly because of the high air conditioning efficiency. There are, other than geothermal, no systems attain the high level of efficiency the geothermal does. So we're able to give SIP dollars based on the air conditioning efficiency. I think that the conservation improvement program should be expanded to allow for conservation dollars that take into account the waste energy that's captured and not used. In other words, the fossil fuel that's not used in these facilities should be accounted for in the conservation program. That's my opinion. Haven't advanced that. Haven't really talked to too many in the state or the Department of Commerce about that until now. So that's my feeling, that there's untapped potential in this technology, especially in the commercial sector.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Doherty, I agree with you. I think that's a really good idea. And I don't know if you followed the new law we passed last year that is going to really strengthen SIP, I think, and really increase the requirements on utilities. So they have a big job to do to get to those energy savings goals we've imposed of 1.5% a year. And so we need to figure out ways to help you get there. Yep. And that sounds like a really good one to me. I'm just wondering, you said, under existing SIP rules, you can do air conditioning only, and that's based on what, on the payback period, or you said on efficiency?
On the comparative efficiency between geothermal and the alternate systems, the lower cost alternate systems that's generally chosen, which can range from anything from a rooftop unit to a central chiller system, but none of those systems achieve the efficiency of geothermal on the air conditioning side.
And then, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering what type of incentive you do provide for that, you know, how much Is it a rebate? Is it a percentage?
It's pretty much standardized. There's so many dollars per. There's a minimum efficiency, and then anything above that, we give incremental dollars for that. I can't give you the amounts right now, or I don't recall those amounts off the top of my head.
But it's a dollar amount that comes off the top of the upfront cost of installing this.
That's how you could think of the SIP dollars. Yes.
That's how you help people finance it.
That's how we help do that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Just the same as if they were installing a very efficient air conditioning system,
mm-hmm.
more efficient than the standard choice. Geothermal takes it a little step further, so there's actually a little bit more dollars available for that. But I'd like to also mention that yes, we've got a significant challenge ahead of us, and we're strategizing. There's a lot of discussion. How are we going to meet this goal? And I think that all the utilities have to cooperate to really do that. And this is a way for all types of regulated utilities to address the higher challenge that we have to meet.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair, that and our 80% CO2 reduction goals, which is part of how we're going to get there. But that again, that's an issue where we really need to work with the Department of Commerce because they really set the standards for SIP, and they need to, you know, they work with the utilities to do that. But we need to make sure they're open to these kinds of ideas.
Yeah, and we'd love to have someone down there who was dedicated or partially dedicated to that,
mm-hmm.
and sort of a go-to person. That would be great. It would give the technology a lot more credibility,
okay.
and better and uh-huh. wider use, and better knowledge.
Senator Dale.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Doherty, on the economic analysis paper that was just passed out, could you tell us a little bit about that? There's some initials there I don't really understand. I mean,
yeah.
just what are the three or four main points we're making? And,
yeah.
and who is a sample customer? It must be a business, I presume.
Yeah, I didn't want to include a name there. This is an actual installation. Prior to when we're helping customers understand this technology and develop a better understanding of it, we do an economic analysis for it because really it comes down to economics. How much is this going to cost me to put in, and what's the value of that investment? How soon is it going to pay back? But businesses don't just look at simple payback. They also look at other things like internal rate of return, net present value, return on investment. So those are all included on this analysis for their information, depending on their decision-making process or their basis for decision-making. So you'll see that there's a 10-year net present value. There's an additional cost on this specific project of $27,517. That's how much more it costs to install a geothermal than the other system that they were considering. We're also showing a 10-year internal rate of return. That's the basis on which some businesses internal rate of return, which they make their economic decisions. We show simple payback of 4.9 years, and we show the annual dollar savings. What's how much is that going to put in my pocket? Simply divide that by 12, come up with the monthly savings, and those are the numbers at the top. We're showing some columns there. Simple payback is a nice way to do a first analysis of any energy efficiency measure. However, it ignores what happens after the simple payback period. There's changes in fuel prices. There's different costs of ownership, life cycle costs of systems. What we found is that the system is less costly to own. There's less maintenance, and there's less replacement. In other words, the heat pumps last a long time. The loop field lasts a long time. They're wholly serviceable. They can be fixed indefinitely and continue running, which keeps your capital replacement costs down. Alternative systems, there's capital replacement components that need to be done after a certain number of years. So the cost of ownership of this system is less. That's what the table below is showing. It shows in line one, first column is the annual heating cooling costs with a geothermal system. The next column was using at the time current fossil fuel costs, in this case I believe natural gas, and that was $11,837. There was a nominal savings of almost $5,700. We look at then going down through the rows. Each row is the next year's energy cost, and there's an inflation rate built in to each of those. So that's what that's showing in the first two columns as you go down the rows. We're showing in the third column the nominal savings. What would What would a customer or business do with that savings? They could invest it. And so we're showing it in, let's see. Oh, I'm sorry. That's the financing costs. The next column is the financing costs of the $27,000. So we're really, really showing them the true costs in the net savings. So they're saying, I'm going to install this energy efficient system. It's going to save me so many dollars per year, but I'm going to have to finance that system. What's it going to cost me after I financed it? That's what the next column, the net savings, is showing. They're still netting more than $2,400 after the investment in this system. And so on and so forth. So we're showing, and then we're in the last column, we're showing what the accumulated costs are over time. That a $27,000 investment really netted them $419,000 after their financing, after you've taken fuel cost changes into consideration.
And is 20 years then considered the lifespan of that system, Mr. Doherty?
No. Okay. I think some of these gentlemen could probably talk more about that, but I've been told that the ground loop lasts hundreds of years. That product that's put in the ground can last many decades. The heat pumps themselves are wholly serviceable. If anything goes wrong with them, components are replaced. So the whole system doesn't have to be replaced ever.
Okay. Senator Dale, did you have another question?
Well, I just want to thank you for that explanation. That's helpful. I know you said what this stands for, but on the project 10-year NPV, zero cost, $0. What does NPV stand for again?
Net present value. And that.
What does that mean?
That takes into consideration the cash flows of that investment over time. And the cash flows, in this particular case, the customer needed a given net present value for a given time period. The cash flows from that investment should equal, or minus the investment, should equal zero in the required period. And so a net present value takes into consideration cash flows.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else, Mr. Doherty, or members?
Yeah, I think I had more, but I can't remember. Thank you. Thank you.
All right.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you for coming, Senator Alcine.
Mr. Chair, first I need to be clear that, you know, I'm very interested in promoting this sort of energy-saving system, but I recognize at this table that there are all of you folks are very interested in, you know, finding ways to save energy, and so I'm just trying to push a piece of the puzzle, and I appreciate the work, the good work that many of you guys have done for many years, and I just want to continue on that area. Now, last person will be Bob Donnelly, and he's a salesman that sells these units, so see if he can sell you guys on one.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Donnelly.
Chairman, Bob Donnelly with Econor Energy Systems. Econor is a Minnesota manufacturing company of geothermal heat pumps. We've been doing that about 22 years, and I'm the sales supervisor at Econor. And I think Senator Osteen has brought together a fine group of presenters for you today. They're all distinguished people that have been in the industry for many years. They know what they're talking about. I'm wondering, is there a confusion by you folks as to how these systems work? You know, we've talked about the benefits and so forth, but I'd be very pleased to simply explain how they work if you'd like me to do that for you today. We haven't really got to that. I don't want to move on to something that we don't feel comfortable with and how they really work. So if there's any confusion, I'm certainly willing to take a minute or two to explain that.
I think that would probably be good, Mr. Donnelly.
Okay. A geothermal system is basically a way of transferring heat from the ground into the home when you're heating, and in the summertime to transfer the heat from the home into the ground. The heat pump establishes a heat difference or a temperature difference. And to try and simplify that, let me go through an example for a typical home in Minnesota. The ground temperature throughout the state of Minnesota is roughly 50 degrees. That's basically the well water temperature. And when we install a heat exchanger in the ground, which is an extension of the heat pump itself, it's an integral part of the heat pump. Without the heat exchanger in the ground, the heat pump will not do anything. So the heat exchanger in the ground is basically a series of plastic pipe, polyethylene pipe. Within that, we transfer the heat from the ground in through the plastic pipe into a water solution. It's freeze protected. There's a small pump that circulates the water throughout that heat exchanger. And in the ground, as I said, it's 50 degrees ground temperature in the wintertime, or throughout the whole year, I should say. The water temperature in the wintertime is probably about 35 degrees average temperature within that ground loop. Heat will always move from warm to cool. Better remember that, warm to cool. That's a natural heat transfer. So the 50-degree ground temperature will transfer through the plastic pipe into the water naturally. There's no energy required to do that. It'll do it naturally. The only energy required to do that is to move the water throughout that pipe. So we bring that warmed up water. The water temperature will probably change about 5 degrees within that earth heat exchanger. It might leave the heat pump at 30 degrees, enter the earth loop heat exchanger, warm up to 35 degrees, and come back into the heat pump roughly at 35 degrees in the wintertime. Once that warmed up water of 35 degrees comes into the heat pump, it enters a heat exchanger. On one side is the water, the warmed up water. On the other side is a cold refrigerant, roughly 25 degree refrigerant. So now we have a heat exchanger again, similar to the earth loop. Now we have water and refrigerant. Water is 35 degrees, refrigerant is 25 degrees. The heat will come out of that water naturally into the refrigerant and warm up that refrigerant 3 degrees or so, 3 to 5 degrees. So in essence, we've moved heat from the ground to the water into the refrigerant all naturally. We haven't introduced a lot of energy here other than moving the water throughout that heat exchanger in the earth loop. It's a closed loop system, so we're simply recirculating that water, changing the temperature within that heat exchanger. And that's the great efficiencies of that system, because we've been able to move, let me back up a little bit, the capacity off the heat pump in the wintertime, roughly 3/4 of that was originated from the ground. In today's systems, we're becoming more and more efficient. These heat pumps are becoming more and more efficient. And so roughly 3/4 of that energy was originated from the ground at one point, and we moved that all the way into the heat pump. There are some internal heat gains with the compressor and the blower, where we gain about 25% of the total capacity. So roughly, if we're delivering 100,000 BTUs, as an example, off the heat pump, which would be a very, very large system, 75,000 BTUs was originated from the ground. And so we're able to then heat the home. Forced air systems will deliver about 100 degree leaving air temperature off a forced air unit. We do have heat pumps that can deliver, not forced air systems, but hydronic systems that can deliver hot water or cold water for air conditioning. Hot water meaning about 115 degree water temperature for heating, and you can use that for multiple ways to heat your home or business. Air conditioning wise, they're extremely efficient as well. Today's heat pumps, as I said, are becoming more and more efficient, and typically today's air conditioning units are probably about 50% more efficient than a traditional air conditioning system that a residents would buy. And on the heating side, they're about energy savings. Let me talk about dollars. The heat pump will be about 1/2 the operating cost of natural gas and about 1/4 the cost of a propane system, roughly, in today's dollars, given what electric rates are and natural gas and propane rates are. So it's an extremely energy efficient and economical system to operate. Now, everyone today has been talking about how much more expensive these systems are to operate up front, and that is the hindrance in our system, along with, I believe, probably consumer awareness. There's really a large lack of consumer awareness in the marketplace. I do many talks throughout the state and at the state fair and so forth, and there's always a large group that's very interested in knowing how these systems work. And that's why I asked today if I could explain how these systems work. So in summary, they're basically a heat transfer system, moving heat out of the ground into the home in the winter, and likewise there's a reversing valve that redirects the refrigerant, redirects the system to take heat out of the home and back into the ground in the summertime. Is that somewhat clear then to everybody?
Well, Mr. Donnelly, I guess other testifiers have mentioned the liquid that that circulates, and you're calling it water, and you're talking about temperatures that are below the freezing point. Does it, what prevents it from freezing within the system?
Sure. The earth loop is freeze-protected. The water that's in there is freeze-protected with an antifreeze solution.
Okay.
It's usually protected to about 15 to 20 degrees Fahrenheit. The coldest part of the entire geothermal system is within the heat pump itself, the heat exchanger where the water comes in from the earth loop and then transfers to the refrigerant. There, that is the coldest part of the entire system, and basically the freeze protection is to protect the heat pump itself, that heat exchanger.
Okay. Senator Rummel.
Mr. Chair, just a curiosity question. What happens to the ground temperature during winter? I'm assuming it's losing temperature. In the summer, it's gaining temperature?
Slightly, right. Thank you. Slightly. The ground temperature within about 4 to 6 feet of that earth loop, the heat exchanger, will be impacted slightly. It might be maybe 5 degrees cooler or warmer than the other natural ground temperature. But likewise, as was mentioned earlier, Minnesota is an excellent location for installing geothermal systems. Because of the seasonality, we have a winter and heating and cooling system, and so we're not always putting heat in the ground or always taking heat out of the ground. We are going back and forth, and so we even out that ground temperature between summer and winter, and that's the real benefit in Minnesota. Minnesota is one of the few, but the northern tier states are actually where geothermal should be installed more and more as compared with the southern states where there's many of these systems going in now. Minnesota, as you probably know, has a lot of groundwater. Water or moisture in the ground is a good conductor of heat. And so not only is the seasonality of geothermal systems important, but the groundwater itself is beneficial to installing these systems as well. I need to make sure this is understood. We're not taking water, groundwater, out of the ground at all. We're simply transferring heat from the ground into the plastic pipe and recirculating that water. We're not using well water at all in the systems that we're talking about today.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Mr. Donnelly, go ahead.
I would like to comment. I was heavily involved with the Wisconsin Geothermal Association at the origination of that association. And yes, the Wisconsin state of Wisconsin supported that association initially, provided the organization by which we could become started. I was on the board of directors for about 8 years, was involved in establishing that association. After about 2 years or so, the association was able to tap into SIP funds in Wisconsin to hire a executive director. And as was said earlier, without that person, that hired person, paid person, the association would not go very far. We do need a person dedicated, an association, a trade association, for it to be effective. So we all are quite busy in our own work. We certainly will volunteer to do what's needed to keep the association going, but we need a person, spearhead, to move forward and to interact with the industry and with consumers. The association is really needed to heighten the awareness of the association, obviously, but heighten awareness of geothermal in general. Consumer awareness is really lacking in the marketplace. And as we said, we're only about 1% of the entire industry. Without greater infrastructure support through the association, which would generate interest by engineers, installing contractors, loop field contractors, this industry will still be very minor in the industry. We need to have an influx of support, and so that's why we're here today.
Okay. Any questions, members? Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Donnelly.
Thank you.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Senator Kubley and members. It's been, I just kind of boggles my mind when I think of only 1% of our heating systems are this way, and if we could change that number dramatically, just about the energy that would be saved in the state. So thank you so much.
I'm doing the next bill.
You want me to chair? Sorry. Okay, I can do that. Welcome to the committee, Senator Kubley. Welcome to the other end of the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, this is a bill that I just introduced in this year's session, but it is really a fairly simple idea. And the concept of a revolving loan fund is here, but it's primarily aimed at local units of government, school districts, and that kind of thing. Because of the upfront costs, it would enable them to get into a system that is a little different than some of the conventional systems without spending any more of their own money initially. You know, they would have to pay that back through the energy savings that they recognize. And we would not encourage them to do this if they were not looking at the replacement of those systems in the first place. So I guess, you know, that's primarily the reason that I offered this bill. You know, I did have one superintendent who mentioned that, and, you know, we got to talking about it a little bit, and that's really the source of where this came from. It's just aimed at, you know, local units of government primarily, but that could include school districts that would be eligible to use this kind of a revolving loan fund. Are there any questions the members would have before we let a few testifiers come up?
So, Senator Kubley, how would that work where the energy savings paid back the loan? I mean, would the individual, you know, school district or the city have to make that calculation themselves? Well, I mean, that would just sort of be done within their own accounting?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, that it could be done either through their accounting or with an independent accounting firm. You know, it would seem to me that the independent one might be found to be more acceptable here. But I think it could be looked at on what a comparable space, you know, in terms of square feet would cost with conventional systems. And then they would be asked to pay the difference back to the state until the loan is repaid. You know, we've heard really quite a variety of terms in terms of how long it might take to repay a system for the upfront cost, the difference in the upfront cost. But, you know, it does seem to me that that could be accomplished and it wouldn't really be costing them any more than their conventional system is costing them under the current payment scenario.
So would this be a no-interest loan?
That would have to be determined. I would hope that it could be kept relatively low for local units of government. I would assume that we could make something on it, but you know, maybe something more in terms of what you and I can get for our savings rather than what commercial lenders might get for the same thing.
I see that you would allow loans to be for up to 10 years, but some of the paybacks could be longer than that, so they'd have to float some of that extra cost.
They probably would, but they could wait until the expiration of their initial contract. You know, and then we could let it go for the 10 years before they had to do that, the second piece.
And do you know how much the loans could be for? I mean, did you cost out what type of dollar amount you're thinking would be needed?
I haven't. I guess my thought was that we would look at an amount that could do, say, 25 systems around the state just so we'd have an adequate pool of data that communities could look at if they were considering the replacement of heating and air conditioning units so that they'd have some sense of, you know, what that same kind of system might yield for them.
I know I've spent some time the last few years trying to get funding binding authority for schools to do renewable energy systems, and it's incredibly difficult. And so this might be an alternative for them to have loan dollars because bonding is, I mean, it's so complicated what the state requirements are for what you can levy for and if you have to have a referendum on it, and they have so many other demands on their bonding dollars. So this might be a good alternative.
Well, I've been a little disappointed, Madam Chair, in traveling the state with the bonding committee looking at, you know, I think we visited at least three Minsky institutions where I asked if they considered geothermal, they all said that they had considered it, and it was not found to be feasible. I guess I'd like to know who's giving them the information. And, you know, it seems to me there are a variety of variables in there that that should be considered before they determine that it's not a viable system. You know, it seems to me that with the information we've heard so far, at least, and maybe the testifiers here will have something different to say, but it does seem to me that maybe they're getting information that's not really up to speed with the technology that's available with the industry for today either.
Shall we listen to your witnesses?
Sure.
Mr. Coriel?
Dennis Coriel is here.
Mm-hmm. Or if you want to come up too, Craig, Mr. Johnson, that's fine. Yeah. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dennis Coriel. I am the city administrator in Baxter, Minnesota. And just by way of a small amount of background, our present city hall is a stick building, not very well insulated, that is heated by a series of furnaces, gas furnaces, that are meant to be installed in homes. It's a 9,000-square-foot building, and now that building has begun to affect our personnel decisions. We need more people to provide a decent level of service. And we need a building that we think would be about 30,000. We've completed a space needs study for the building. And we are seriously committed to building a green city hall. Whether it will be LEED certified or not is the farthest thing from our mind right now. But we're very interested in geothermal. And what brought us to that decision was that while we were doing the space needs study for this building, an entrepreneur in Baxter built a green office park. And that green office park is visited by many folks every day, just visiting, trying to see what's going on. And we could see the leadership kind of falling away from the city and going elsewhere. But we would like to be in a leadership position as to our government center, which we're building. And my experience so far, and my staff's experience as well, is that we go to architects and engineers, people that cities have always dealt with, and we say, how many LEED certified architects or engineers do you have on your staff? And the numbers that we get from them when we ask them about geothermal are really all over the place. And I think I've heard it here in the testimony today. What is the payback period? That's the first question everybody asks me, and so that's the first one I ask them. What is the payback period to install a geothermal system in this city hall? And one number I heard was two years. The biggest number I heard was 10 years. The company, BKV, that gave me the 10-year figure asked a lot of other questions to go along with it, because there are so many variables when you're talking about saving energy, building a sustainable building, one that's friendly to the environment and which saves money and doesn't leave, you know, a huge debt for our kids and our grandkids to pay. But I also heard from many other companies that said, oh, it's about 3 or 4 years, but they didn't ask any questions. So our strategy has been to meet face-to-face with these folks and ask them many of the same questions that you're asking here today from the folks who have already testified. But let me give you some idea of what we've experienced as far as investigating geothermal. I think that our city council is absolutely committed to doing many green LEED-inspired kinds of things with our building so that we can be kind to the environment and save plenty of money. Our building at 30,000 square feet is going to require a $200,000 investment for the entire system, at least $50,000 more than the next most efficient system, which we understand to be a high-efficiency gas system. Across the street from where we're going to build this, City Hall, is one of the largest middle schools in the state, Forest View Middle School in Baxter. It has something like 2,500 kids in there. Now, the school district turned down the opportunity to build geothermal into their building, and the reason was because of the upfront cost. And that has been a concern in the city of Baxter as well. I would hazard a guess that that's the bottom line question. And that's why I applaud you for thinking about a fund that would help out anyone that's got their eye on the bottom line and must answer lots of residents and users of the building. What are you folks doing here? We think, or we have been told, that the payback period in our case for that 30,000 square foot building is going to be about 10 years. That's the worst case scenario. But we're still interested in it. The initial cost is our biggest concern. What is that payback period going to look like? There is another big picture question that was expressed to me by Rick Carter, who teaches at the U. He's an engineer and an architect for LHB Company, and quite well known. And his big picture question is this. All right, you're going to be using a lot less fossil fuel, maybe no fossil fuel, who knows, but you're going to be using a lot less, but aren't your pumps and all the electrical equipment that has to go with that system, isn't that going to generate the need for more electric plants or greater capacity of the present plants or new plants? We've all heard about all the new plants going up in the Dakotas. And our answer to that, and we know it's only a partial answer, is that the partnership that was to have built all these new plants is kind of falling apart right now. I haven't seen anything about it in the news. It's almost as if there were a blackout. But it looks like the partnership isn't what it was. There are fewer people who have been going to be generating electricity yet. And the other thing is that besides the heating and the cooling system in the building, there are other ways to produce some of your own energy. Our green office park has a solar collector there that generates enough electricity to run all the computers in the building. It started with an accounting firm, and now they do all kinds of estate planning and stuff like that. Computer-intensive buildings. Well, for them to be able to sell electricity back to Crow Wing County at the end of the day and thereby make their bill a little more moderate, they put up a very small solar collector. It's out by the road. People say, what is that? It looks like it's from outer space. But it could just as easily go up on a roof or it's in a woods. You could put it in the back of the woods where the sun shines all the time. It doesn't matter. But the city of Baxter is going to need some help on the upfront money. Just to give you a couple of thoughts that we have on this, if we have to purchase this building, it's going to cost us $7 to $9 million plus financing costs. The interest rate on a muni bond these days can be 4-5% or more. If the fund that you folks are talking about were similar to many other revolving loan funds that originate in the legislature, the percentage of the interest rate could be as low as 1 or 2% and make a real difference for many of these cities. I'm aware of 6 cities right now that are coming close to committing to building a green city hall. A couple of them are building right now. But philosophically, too, relations between state and local government have not been as friendly and cooperative as they should be. I believe that the cities often sit back and say, well, you know, and that this or that legislator didn't get through their carping. They're saying they didn't go through this, the city council and the planning and zoning way to get to the legislature and similar things. And look at all those unfunded mandates. And the legislature's saying, oh, well, the cities have become an ordinary lobbying organization. And there could be truth on both sides, I got to tell you. But anyway, philosophically, I think, and my mayor, Daryl Olson, thinks as well, I believe the whole council, if we were to poll them, would agree as well. This is a perfect thing to start a partnership, especially if it were going to include counties and school districts. That school district would have done that building across the street from where the city hall is going to go. They would have done that, except for the initial cost of it. People were starting to say, this school is so big, it must be a Taj Mahal. Well, maybe. So we hear that about 18 times a day, but there are very few of those around. If the school district had had enough initial money in their pocketbook to pay for that, they would have done it.
Great. Thank you very much. You're getting the wheels spinning in my head here, a lot of good ideas, and I'm thinking maybe we need a new kind of local government aid, some green LGA. How do you like that?
Yeah, I love it, because we don't get any LGA.
Yeah, right. If we could at least get something there that would give these incentives that we need. Yeah, well, anyway, we'll see. But, and it's getting, also thinking when you brought up solar, I was thinking the same thing, that if you had a loan fund that could be used for a variety of different programs, sometimes they could really complement each other. So you could install a geothermal system and some solar at the same time to help pay for the electric costs. And so the overall system would be a big cost saver. But just doing the one without the other might be a little more difficult. Mr. Johnson. Oh, yeah. Well, let's let Mr. Johnson have a turn here. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, not an ordinary, but an extraordinary association of lobbying interests for cities. Comments that you've already heard from testifiers really do speak, I think, to why we have a number of cities that are becoming more and more interested. In your information, I saw two city halls already built that are using geothermal already. You've heard from Mr. Coriel that Baxter is looking at it. I can tell you, we do regional meetings every year that many of you have attended at some point or another in the past. We had one at Breezy Point that the city of Baxter had a number of folks at, and, of course, lots of other cities from that part of the state attend these meetings. And one of the highlights for our local officials is we have a little segment right before dinner where everyone gets to kind of stand up and give a report on what their cities have done in the past year or what, you know, big projects are underway. One of Baxter's updates was they're looking at this new city hall, and they hope to be going forward with geothermal and a green theme, you know, a green building theme. And this was the busiest guy we had at the social hour that immediately followed that, because a number of city officials were coming up saying, how are you doing that? Who are you working with? What are the differences in costs? People really are interested in this. Cities are looking at this for a number of reasons. One is obviously there's a tremendous interest in sustainability, in energy sustainability being one of those, but land use sustainability, transportation sustainability. To our annual conference theme for the League of Minnesota Cities this last year was sustainable development. It was the focus of our conference in Duluth last June. And it really is one of the things our city officials and city staff are insisting that we all ramp up for, because they're being expected to, they want to, and it's going to take a lot of work to get 855 cities on the same learning curve on some of this stuff. There is a lot of awareness and interest in reducing carbon footprint. That's one of the reasons that things like geothermal are very attractive. Cities have a challenge, especially cities that very seldom have a replacement of a fleet or a new building going in. You only have so many opportunities as a city to take that kind of role. And so looking at these kinds of opportunities while building a new city building really is one of the few places we can do that. It also is important to look at reducing costs. Energy costs, our after healthcare costs, one of our most draining and quickly rising costs we have in city government. And we do need to save costs on energy wherever we can, especially on public buildings. And I think, as you heard Mr. Coriel mention for the city of Baxter, our cities really do want to be seen as the leader in these type of issues. When the community says, well, what can we do when I'm retrofitting my home or building a new home, we all hope, as our city officials all hope, that the place people would look is to their city and say, well, what have they been able to do and how did it work for them? So I think this kind of program really helps with those kind of goals that cities have of trying to be in a lead role on something that's important to their constituents and is cutting edge. And I think that this legislation that's being discussed is very key to doing that. There are a number of obstacles in the way of getting these systems in, upfront capital being the biggest one. You have a certain amount of money to work with. If the cost of that system, as you heard with the school district example, is going to significantly change what that upfront cost is, even though it might pay for itself over a shorter period of time, it may not be an option for you because the upfront cost is what you're having to limit your project by, not, you know, will it pay off in 10 years or 15 or 20 or whatever it happens to be for other types of systems. And there also is the need for space. You have to decide what type of space you have for your systems, what, you know, how much room do you have to work with? How much space is it going to take to do this? I think assistance being suggested in Senator Kubley's bill will go a long ways towards helping do that, and I really do appreciate the legislation being put forward. I think there would be a lot of interest from cities if such a program were put forward. I'm betting for the interest we have, school districts would have 10 times as much because they have a lot more construction of buildings going on than cities do. We don't build a whole lot, and when we do, the chair mentioned earlier the idea of when projects are built with state funds having a requirement, and there was other legislation, I believe, last year to look at having a requirement that at least geothermal be considered during the planning process, which we were fine with as a consideration, but most city projects do not use state funds other than water treatment plants. Which are not a place where we're doing a lot of heating and cooling. So, but a city hall normally is not built with state funds. So this is a way that we can leverage through positive incentives some of those types of changes rather than putting it as a restriction on if you use state funds, you must do this. You can say, hey, if you're willing to do this, we have a program set up that can help you get it done. I think it would have a very positive benefit.
Thank you. Senator Dill, are you about to ask? I was going to ask your question again about why not private financing, and I don't know if you were going to ask that again. But I guess you're talking about a lower interest rate, but I don't know if there's another reason. Go ahead, Senator Dill.
Well, my question is just something I've been kind of wondering about, which is not a little bit off the subject, but the center of our Earth is pretty hot, and we need more energy, and we're talking about going down 150 feet to get this heat. And it's about 50 degrees at that level, but how deep do you have to go before it really gets hot?
Senator Dill, I don't think we got the engineers here. So.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Dill, my last research on deep drilling geothermal energy was when I was a high school debater, and we were debating renewable energy in the late 70s, so I'm going to pass on that, giving you an answer to that one.
Okay, good question, though. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, to your question about private financing, I would answer quickly with two, and it's the exact same reason that you see so much of a backlog of requests for state funding for water infrastructure projects. Mm-hmm. When the state provides funding for these programs, even if it's a loan, not only is the interest rate generally subsidized by a couple of points to help make it a more affordable loan, but the issuance costs for the debt are covered by the state because the state typically issues bonds to generate that loan account money. And so it means we also don't have to do the debt issuance costs that we would otherwise have to do as part of that project. So it saves money in both of those.
Now, you make an assumption that if we were to do this, we'd want to use bonding dollars. And I would argue that might be harder to do. But depending on we don't know, depending on what our forecast looks like in terms of cash, but for bonding, you know, if we've been, some of us have been talking about if there's a way to use energy savings, like a performance bond, performance contract type, where you use the energy savings to try to pay it off, then you wouldn't have to bid under the other limits that we have for bonding, which will be very in big demand. That $1 billion or whatever it is that we're going to be able to pass is going to be, you know, I think there's $3 or $4 billion in bonding requests already for that. So that, you know, that's an issue about where we could find the money is a big issue. But I hear what you're saying about the advantages.
And Madam Chair, in either case, it avoids the local government having to do the issuance of bonds there.
Yeah.
So it's the cost savings is there either way for, for us. It's up to the state how they decide to help us.
Thank you for that opportunity to help you. All we need to do is find the money. Thank you very much. We should get the last witness up here. Bill Clive?
Cleavy,
sorry.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
My name is Bill Cleavy. I'm with Otter Tail Power Company. We're out in the western part of the state.
It's a great place to live, Madam Chair.
And my job is to deal with customers on energy efficiency issues to try to help them become more energy efficient, predominantly to help them stay in business so we can keep them as customers out there, as Senator Kubley can probably testify to as well. We struggle to keep people out there and to keep jobs and to keep people there. Otter Tail Power Company has been a leader in the geothermal systems. At last check, I know we had more geothermal heat pumps per 1,000 customers than any other utility in the nation. I don't know that that necessarily means we're the best at it, but we do have a lot of them out there. We do a lot of work with the CIP program. We currently offer both rebates and or low-interest financing on geothermal heat pumps. One of the problems is they can't have both. They can either have a rebate of $18 per 1,000 BTUs of heating capacity, or they can choose the 2.9% financing. In almost every case, they're better off with the rebate. So the low-interest financing doesn't come into play. If we had a program where we could offer both, which would mean we'd have to have more SIP dollars, obviously, to cover that. But I think kind of the vehicle is in place that we're talking about if we could achieve all of that. I don't know if that's legally achievable or proper to do or any of that kind of stuff. But the way my visit started here, I think Senator Kubley asked Bob Thompson, city manager of Appleton, to come and testify, and Bob basically said, I don't know anything about geothermal heat pumps. Get Bill Cleavy with Otter Tail Power. He knows what he's doing. And I actually worked on that project like 17 or 18 years ago. It was one of my first projects as an energy manager to work on. And at that time, we were dealing with natural gas at about 40 or 50 cents a therm, which we were still able to prove to them a substantial savings by doing a geothermal system. At that time, I think it was only like a $20,000 incremental cost difference, given the situation they were in, to put in the geothermal system versus replacing the conventional system. But the savings at that time were only about $4,000, $4,500 a year. So it didn't quite fall into the category of a no-brainer like some of them do at less than 1 year. There was some decisions to be made, but they made the decision to go ahead with the geothermal. I did do some quick calculations on it based on today's natural gas prices, and they have chosen to be on Otter Tail's interruptible electric rate, which is 2.4 cents a kilowatt hour year-round with no demand charge, which is an incredibly low price. Their total heating and cooling costs for a 30,000-square-foot building are $3,561.70. converted to natural gas heating, the heating alone would be $17,870.50. Cooling costs would be $4,870.30. So they're basically realizing a $17,179 savings per year, which if we had these kinds of numbers when they made that decision, we would have been into the 1.5 or 2 year payback period. But that's not necessarily the standard rule. There, like has been said by a number of testifiers here today, all buildings are different. I did the analysis for the West Central School in Barrett, for example. They were talking about putting in a propane system with a conventional chiller. Versus the geothermal system, it came out to a 0.9-year payback. Well, nobody had to think about that one for very long. But the ones that come out to 8 or 9 or 10-year paybacks are sometimes a struggle for people, especially if they're going to borrow the money and the cost of money. My own personal house included, that I have it in my own house, but it turned out to be like a 9 or 10-year payback. There was some other issues with my house, including aesthetics. When I showed my partner what the air source heat pump condensing unit was going to look like and how big it was and where I was going to put it, there was a fairly lively domestic discussion about the flowers. And, needless to say, I spent the extra money and put in the geothermal system. So, you know, basically, it wasn't my best payback in number of years compared to a storage system. But now it's been over 10 years, and other energy prices have gone up dramatically, as you all know. And I've had zero problems with it. And it's been a great choice. But that's, I would strongly support Senator Kubley's bill. If we had more ammunition out there, we could basically sell more of them.
Hey, thank you. Senator Dill.
Yeah, Madam Chair, to the witness or Senator Kubley, is there some way to decrease the cost of this by, or is it even feasible for, say, two homeowners or four homeowners to go together and cooperate on a single system that would provide heat exchange to the two houses that it's between or that are on either side of it? Or is there some way to spread the cost out somehow in a joint system so it doesn't cost so much per house?
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, it's been tried, okay? It's been tried on a number of occasions. There's even one, it happens to be right across the border in Fargo, where they're doing a sort of a community loop field. There's a number of issues involved in that. You know, who actually owns it? If there's a dig-in and there needs to be a repair done to it, who pays for it? I did do a two-house system up in Crookston, Minnesota, years ago, where basically they put in a very, very undersized loop field and a buried storage tank. And the deal between the two homeowners was that they would both use it for air conditioning and only one home would use it for heating to try to balance the load. You know, it's been said here before today, it works well here because of our balance. Minnesota is perfectly suited for it. We are at the exact spot climatically to use these things. But you live in Crookston, Minnesota, your heating needs are greater than your cooling needs for a residential application. Commercial applications are very, very close to balance. I haven't really seen one yet that I would say is a success story of a community-type loop field to reduce the cost. I am aware of one in Canada where there's an outside owner that actually owns the loop field and basically sells BTUs. that one is not exactly meeting with the greatest acceptance of the end users either. So I...
All right. I just want to ask one more question, and then I think we need to wrap up, and I know some members have to leave. I think some utilities, I'm aware of a program that one utility had where they offered a loan program, but it was used the energy savings to pay themselves back. And so because it was offered by the utility, it was recouped directly by the utility through their, you know, they had to provide less energy to this consumer, and so they just took it out of their bills. And so the borrower really didn't have to do anything except wait for their bill to drop once it was all paid off. Have you looked at doing something like that at Otter Tail?
Yes, Madam Chair, we did, and we have.
Okay.
We have done those things. The unfortunate part is, according to our people that know auditing and money and things like that, we're supposed to be charging 7.9% interest, which is rolled into that.
For what? For the loan?
For the loan.
I thought you said you did 2.9% interest.
We do offer the 2.9 in lieu of the rebate on right. The geothermal, but it's one or the other.
But the 7.9, where does that come from?
That's the standard interest rate if they take the $18 per 1,000 BTUs of heating capacity cash rebate. They're both SIP dollars, mm-hmm. Madam Chair. They're both the same dollars. It's just whether you come out better using the 2.9 financing or taking the check.
Yeah, well, it sounds like, we talked about earlier, you know, the SIP programs they're going to have to be improved. Mm-hmm. To get higher energy savings. That's right. What we're requiring into the future. And so this is something we need to look at, if there's ways we can make those more work better for people. And so we need to work with Commerce and the utilities to do that. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Before people leave, I just want to make an announcement to remind you that the full committee tomorrow is going to visit two wastewater treatment plants. And what we did... I know some members around the state have gone to see some of the bonding tours of some of the wastewater treatment plants. Some of those, are you on the bonding committee, Senator Dales? You've probably seen many of them. But we decided as a committee, as the finance division, what we wanted to do was try to identify a couple of the best that are out there. And so we asked the PCA for their opinion about what the best technology was in place at wastewater treatment plants around the state. So these are not systems that are coming to the state asking for money. We just want to go to learn and to observe what they're doing, because they have some of the best technology for removing phosphorus at these two plants. I think Shakopee and Mankato, or St. Peter, is where we're going. So the van will be leaving at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, right in front of the Capitol, and I hope you're all there. It's going to be kind of an all-day tour.
Yeah, and just one other thing before we break up, Madam Chair. You know, I went to a solar conference out in Washington, D.C., and I know I visited with Senator Anderson briefly a couple of times, and we'll probably be looking at having another hearing on looking at what the state might do to make solar a little more competitive than it currently is. I think that's going to happen pretty quickly within the next 7 or 8 years, but you know, I think we'll be taking a look at solar energy at a similar hearing in January. So thank you. Just wanted to give you a heads up on that.
And Senator Kubley, it just makes me think as well. Someone told me the other day that if you have a green roof on your building, you save something like 20% or 30% in your cooling costs just from having that green roof. And I don't know how much they cost to install. But again, maybe we should get some information about that, because we need to really make sure that all the options are out there that work best for different projects.
Usually in new construction that puts solar on the roof is
a green roof. Also.
A green roof.
Makes sense.
It's green in more ways than one, Madam Chair.
And Senator Kubley, with your permission, I'll adjourn the meeting. We're done? All right. The meeting's adjourned. Thank you, members.